My name is Larry Norris. I'm the co-founder of Decriminalize Nature and the National Organizing Director. I've been lucky enough to help folks all across the U.S. Pass policy locally on their municipalities to basically decriminalize entheogenic plants and fungi. If you'd like to help out and you're in an area they want to do some policy shifts, make sure to contact us at decriminalizenature.org and join the movement. It's a growing movement. Pretty excited. We're hoping to have 5 to 10 more cities pass this year. So join in and participate. I'd also like to join or introduce our behind the scenes maverick there, Rachel, who's been instrumental in helping us with this whole project. Thank you again, Rachel, for all your help and support in this Decriminalized Nature podcast. And we're now, helping, thanks to Rachel's help, on quite a few new platforms. We are on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, YouTube. I think this is live on YouTube as well today. So keep that in mind. And also, if you'd like to make a donation, I believe there is now a donation button on our podcast. So if you want to help support this amazing movement and show, you can now do so on these different podcast platforms by clicking on the donate button. Also, at the end of the conversation, Rachel will be opening up to answer any questions or open up the floor for any questions that come in. So if you have any thoughts, comments, questions, or anything like that, go ahead and put them in the chat box and we'll be sure to answer them towards the end of the show. So I'm really excited today to have our next guest. Our next guest is Reverend Dr. Pamela Hancock. Pamela is a professor at Starr King School for Ministry. She's a chaplain, a psychedelic researcher, and explorer of the archetypal and artistic realms. We've had a few incredible conversations in the past. I'm really excited to see where today's conversation takes us and where this exploration goes for us. So thank you for being here. How are you today, Pamela?
Thank you, Larry. I'm good. Just defrosting after some snow here in the Southern California mountains, but otherwise, good.
Fantastic. Thank you for being here, even in the snow. Maybe we could start off with a little background bio. Tell us a little bit about who you are and anything you'd like us to know, how you got involved in this area as well.
Oof. Wow. Well, let's see, background. So, probably like many listeners, I came to this wonderful world in the 90s rave scene. Having a lot of fun in the SoCal specifically rave scene in the mid 90s. It was at that point where I personally fell in love with LSD, which, although is not directly from nature, it is an ergot derivative, so it's kind of from nature. And school took me in a lot of different directions. I have a strange bachelor's degree in museum studies, history, and creative writing. But after that, I really wanted to have a spiritual job. So I ended up attending Starr King School for the Ministry about 10 years ago now. Had been on the track to become a prison chaplain. But while I was working at San Quentin, my supervisor said, "Oh, you can't get a job here." And I went, "What? Why?" He's like, "We don't hire interfaith chaplains. We only hire people from specific traditions." And so my whole world just kind of got blasted apart at that point, during which time I decided that there was a huge gap in my learning, not as a fault to the school at all, just that there is the spiritual piece, but there's also the psychological piece, and the psychological piece wasn't being addressed enough in my education. So I decided to go to Pacifica Graduate Institute to get my PhD in depth psychology with an emphasis in Jungian and archetypal studies, because, the longer the title, the better. After which, I got approached by Starr King to create a chaplaincy program. Where I kind of helped fill in the gaps from my education for the people who are coming to Starr King now to be a chaplain. But after that, we had a class taught called The Sacred and the Substance by Aize, who I'm sure you know, Larry. And due to some strange things that happened at the school, he ended up leaving. And another professor and I, Tyson Casey, decided to co-direct the psychedelics program that was kind of bubbling up. So we now have a certificate in psychedelic justice and companioning. That is a four-class certificate that includes the class in deep listening for all forms of ministry, psychedelic ministry methods, which is actually happening right now, a class in policy led by Larry, and also a class on the history of psychedelics. So it gives people the opportunity to kind of utilize like ministry driven techniques and ways of showing up to help people, not just as a guide, but in other ways as well. During that time as well, as all of this was happening, I went to get training in psychedelic integration work. So that's something that I bring to my class as well. And then I also provide that in my spiritual coaching practice, which is Sacred Path Coaching. So just doing a lot of things all at once. But what's been really awesome about this is that all of these like streams, all of these synchronicities that have kind of accumulated in my life to here and now have brought me to this place of working with sacred medicine, which really has been a passion of mine since the 90s, but just now being able to kind of come out into the light.
Yeah, wow, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing all that. Yeah, and I know for those of us, I'm sure Rachel as well and myself, you know, coming from the, you know, 90s scene in Detroit as well, where a lot of, you know, hardcore techno and, you know, just that sort of intersection of music and dance and substances, and like how beautiful that is to find these spaces where, you know, I often say, people always say, oh, well, you know, you have to do it this spiritual way or whatever else. And I was like, man, I can't tell you how many times I've been slapped upside the head with spirit just on the dance floor, you know, or we're having this conversation. And, you know, all of a sudden you don't expect it. And I think that's almost some of the most mind-blowing ones, because, you know, you are not expecting it. And then all of a sudden you have this profound insight about nature of reality, nature of consciousness, nature of self, and like really can connect with that. So I think, you know, this sort of, we sort of backdoored this process a little bit in some of these unusual ways, but I really appreciate that you're coming from that sort of that experience, because, you know, then you're also sort of seeing, you know, how are people doing this in reality? You know, how are having people having these experiences that aren't maybe necessarily through some tradition or not necessarily through some sort of psychotherapeutic approach or not necessarily through some sort of spiritual approach, but definitely healing, definitely connection to nature, and definitely a spiritual sort of format. You spoke a little bit about sort of this intersection of spirituality and psychology and depth psychology. Maybe could you explain for the listeners who maybe aren't really too familiar with that, what does that intersection look like, and how is spirituality and psychology close, but there's still that gap? Maybe can you speak a little bit about that gap?
Sure. So I feel like that gap can be extraordinarily deep and wide depending on the type of psychology from which somebody is coming, because there are very secular, you know, spirit isn't involved forms of psychology. I, on the other hand, went primarily to a program with Jung, C.G. Jung, at the forefront, because of the fact that, so for those of you who don't know, contemporary of Freud, actually was a student of Freud, was in analytical psychology. It eventually became depth psychology just because there was a break at some point. But the interesting piece about that is Jung was looking at the world, I feel, through a very spiritual lens, because he was raised by a minister, and it was a very specific time between World War I and World War II when we still had, I think, intrinsically a spiritual lens that we don't have anymore, because we've kind of gotten so far away from spirit due to maybe evangelicalism and a lot of other issues that have created that gap. But the beautiful thing about Jungian psychology is it allows for spirit. It allows for there being an other that we can't understand. Within the realm of Jungian psychology, there's the idea of synchronicity, so that there are things that happen in your life that are kind of guiding you along a path, that things pop up multiple times that are trying to show you something or trying to lead you somewhere. So within the context of chaplaincy, it was really important for me to help my students understand that even when perhaps you aren't even chaplaining someone who has a spiritual background, that leaving room for the mystery is so important, because We don't proselytize. The beautiful thing about Star King is it's a Unitarian Universalist seminary, and thus we're coming at it from an interfaith perspective, where we don't want to walk into a space as a chaplain and have someone be afraid that they're going to start talking to them about Jesus, right? So there's most of my students actually are pagan. And so having a psychological framework that, as I said, allows for the mystery, but also brings in the processing that happens within one's mind in the search for meaning. So meaning making is a really huge piece of how I teach at Star King, because that's the psychological piece that we're clicking into. So there's the spiritual, of course, which means a lot to many different people, so I'm not going to dive into that. But when it comes to the psychological piece, it's really about meaning making and how a person does that from their own perspective. And that can be spiritual, and it doesn't have to be. So that's the psychological piece that was kind of missing in my training when I was going through to be a chaplain, because we weren't, there was a lot of focus on what's the person's tradition, where are they coming from, are they Hindu, are they Buddhist, are they Christian, how can you then help them within that context. And as people become more and more secular and less in particular religious traditions, it's that meaning-making piece that is so intrinsic to what's going on. I think that answered your question.
That's great. Yeah, I think, you know, meaning making is so important, because you also think about, like, how, you know, it's not about whether or not it's true, it's what's the effect on the individual, how do they sort of unpack it, you know. And I think when we look at, you know, I've done some interesting research just in terms of even just the development of modern day psychology, which really a lot of it is stemming from Freud. Mm-hmm. And there's a bifurcation between Freud and Jung, right, where Jung kind of went off into this more spiritual, mystical, wonder and awe, synchronicities, coincidence, like all these very strange and unusual, almost parapsychological looks at psychology. And then Freud went to a little bit more sort of, you know, this type, you know, and Jung also had that as in his early years, you know, with a little bit more sort of Bergolzi Institute, a little bit more psychotherapeutic, that type of thing. What do you think, and this is just sort of there's no answer to this, but what do you think today's psychology would be like if, instead of going in the Freudian route, everything went to the Jungian route? And how would we be viewing psychology, or even talking about plant medicines and sacred experiences? It seems like it's better encapsulated through, like, a Jungian view of modern day psychology than it would be maybe a Freudian view. Or even if we go into the idea, we talked about Otto Gross before, but that's another strange character that is in that whole system there. But let's just focus on Jung. Mm-hmm. What do you think today's psychology would look like if we went more of a Jungian path versus Freudian path?
I really feel like there would be, so I wonder how much there would have been the New Age movement earlier, because I feel like that kind of sprung out of people looking for something else. They didn't want a man behind a pulpit and a book written by literally two different groups of people that has been squished, hashtag the Bible, into one user manual. I think that people would have started seeking sooner for other ways to experience truth in their lives. As one of the major factors of Jungian psychology, and one of the things that I integrate heavily into a class that I teach that's specifically Jungian psychology for chaplains, is the concept of the religious function of the psyche. So Jung said that within our mind, it's already built in to be doing this meaning making, to be looking for something outside of ourselves, for like why something is happening to us. So I think that if that would be a beautiful thing if we hadn't gone the Freudian route and had gone the Jungian route, because then I think that there wouldn't have been as much of a focus on like sex and dysfunction and all of the dark places that really Freud was coming from. I mean, Freud was operating, I think, all from the place of his shadow. So all of the stuff that he had repressed was what he was kind of forcing onto his psychological model. And that was the reason why Jung walked away from Freud. So if we had gone with the Jungian model, which is this meaning making and searching and like sacred and symbol, like he really focused on symbols and what people are attracted to and what that means for them. And I think they're what it's like searching for gold, right? Like he was more about like putting sand in the little sleuth and shaking it to discover that those nuggets of what's powerful and important to somebody instead of pointing fingers. I feel like there's a lot of like Freudian, like, oh, this is what's wrong with you. And that's not where Jung was coming from. So I actually think we would probably be a lot better off because there wouldn't have been all that focus on all of the darkness in the negative. Like, of course, Jung also does shadow work and also asks humans to like dive deep and reintegrate the things that we've oppressed in our lives, but that's different than saying you're wrong for this, you know?
Yeah, it seems like a lot of today's psychology is very much pathologizing, and even how you're seeing some of the psychedelic research that's coming out, it's all about pathology versus like, you know, what does this mean about spirit, or what does this mean about the space beyond? And I was just this morning listening to some of the telepathy tapes, and like, you know, like just the idea that so many people have been like, no, the telepathy isn't a thing. But like, had we explored a little bit more of a Jungian framework, maybe there would be at least an openness to this, and maybe we'll have discovered this stuff even sooner. So I think that's really fascinating. Now, I know one thing about Jung that he did that was really powerful and significant for all of his later writings. And I almost look at this as like, if we had started with this book, we might have understood the other writings much better. And I think folks that have just gotten really great with his collected works but haven't read the Red Book are maybe missing out on a lot. So for folks out there, I don't know if you've done a little research on that. Can you explain a little bit about the Red Book and kind of what was the process for Jung? And it was almost like, I think he even said it reminds him of a mescaline experience, as he said in one of his frameworks there. So do you have any sort of any thoughts on the Red Book in terms of his inspiration and motivation?
Oof, that's a tough one, Larry, because I actually don't think we should have had access to the Red Book. I mean, I'm looking right now at my massive copy of it that's like the size that it actually is, which is like this big, right? And he was really doing I would say like a mystic's work at that point. He was doing a deep dive into visions that were coming up from his unconscious. So he created or perfected, depending on how you look at it, this concept of active imagination, in which you directly engage with images that are coming up from your unconscious. So he was doing a lot of work around, he did all of this amazing work with medieval alchemical texts. So I believe that there was a lot of collective knowledge that was bubbling up from those texts from him, after which he wrote the Red Book, which is him creating these absolutely stunning images, mandalas, just beautiful, absolutely beautiful paintings, and then engaging with the content of those by almost, like you say, going on these like almost mescaline-like journeys to speak to these, I believe, things that are popping up from the collective unconscious to talk to him about the work that he was doing to really peel back the layers of his own soul. I am probably one of the very few people who have graduated from Pacifica who, I mean, it was his diary. Like, I don't think that we were really supposed to read it in the first place. I mean, that's been something I think Jean Bassani actually writes about that in the intro to the newer copy of how this is, you know, this is his private world. And I remember I actually got to see the Red Book. It was in Santa Barbara when I was at school, and it it felt like kind of Ark of the Covenant-y to me, like I shouldn't be looking at this. So yeah, I mean, it does resemble a sacred medicine journey, but I also don't think we should have been messing with it. We should have access to it. But you're right, it does shed light on his mystical mindset in a way that I think like the collective works doesn't.
Right, because that was, I mean, what 1913 was about when he was 1913, 1920, I think he was writing that. So yeah. So what an interesting, yeah. And I also agree that maybe we don't have access to it, but boy, am I pleased that we do, because I think for me, it helps you understand where he was coming from a lot of these other ideas, where he had to like sort of then ground himself to some degree and like come up with psychological language to really talk about the mystical, talk about the spiritual, talk about entities and archetypes, you know, because even in some of those Red Book writings, he was talking about like, you know, do you exist? Are you real? And it's like, of course, you know, like they're responding as if, yes, actually we are. And we have independent agency outside of you. And I think that for somebody in that era was probably pretty mind blowing, you know, trying to figure out and grok that. And then you start thinking about symbols and how they have their own sort of livelihood and all that. I know you, as you said earlier, that you're doing a lot of work with psychedelic integration as well. How do you see the Red Book as kind of like Jung's integration process? And then are there any tools from that you like sort of help people with in terms of your own coaching with integration?
Yeah. I think that the Red Book is both the trip and the integration, because I think that, and there is a lot of research done about this, and I can't remember the name of the book right now, but that artists, when they're creating art, are kind of acting as channels for these archetypal energies, these entities from the collective unconscious who are coming through and are actually the beings behind the art, while the artist is just kind of that intermediary. So I believe that in the same way that we can look at art as that type of channeling, he was doing that. And he was doing that not only with the art that he was creating for the Red Book, but also the writings that came along with them, because it does sound very channeled. You know, like there are these other beings who are talking to him directly. So it's interesting to think of it as integration work, because when I look at it, I really think it's more the trip as it's unfolding. That being said, art is one of the huge pieces that I do use in my coaching practice, regardless of if it's for psychedelic integration or not. But one of the things that I like to do with my clients who perhaps have not been integrated, so one of my pet peeves about what's happening in the psychedelic world right now, I mean, apart from appropriation in general, apart from people going down to South America and having one, you know, powerful experience with ayahuasca and then coming back and saying they're a shaman, that other than that being a huge problem, there are also the people who are doing that, coming back, giving people medicine, and then just never seeing them again. So as a result of that, we have a lot of people, there's no way to calculate how many people, but there are a lot of people who are walking around, perhaps with something really powerful having happened to them without any context, and that not fully showing up in their body and their psyche and in their soul in the ways that it can, if they get led through a process of integrating that work. And in my coaching, one of the pieces that I do with people that has been really powerful is, you know, having them go through an art process where they dive deep, they almost do an active imagination process, allowing an image or a feeling or something else to come back to them from that sacred medicine journey that they did, and then being able to dialogue with it, which is very much active imagination. So, I use my training as a depth psychologist in very specific ways when it comes to my practice, because Jung perfected it, and he didn't necessarily do it with sacred medicine as the reason why he was doing it, but because we can use these techniques where we can feel back into something that happened in these very powerful experiences, and then dialogue with it and learn from it and be given maybe the messages that they were unable to access during the actual medicine journey itself, maybe because they didn't have a guide that was doing anything, maybe because the person who was giving them the medicine actually didn't know what they were doing. There are lots of reasons why there is misuse of these substances at this point in time. But I think that all stems back from education and understanding the long lineage that these medicines hold. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who are giving people they are actual sacred medicines, aren't coming from it from that perspective. I see, at least even the conference where you and I met, Larry, like there's a lot of people walking around with dollar signs in their eyes that don't care about being the ally, the holder of the medicine that they're sharing with people. Just kind of went off there, but it's like one of my pet peeves. It's like a huge peeve.
Yeah, I know. I think about that a lot too, having sort of a, history as well, doing a lot of integration work and stuff like that, and seeing almost in a way, it's like, you kind of almost, it's two different areas. Because, although I don't agree with like the one and done and you're out and you never see the person again kind of thing either, but it's like, there has to be a group of people that can do integration work, because the guide isn't going to have enough time with all the people they're going through, or the facilitator, to be able to do integration work with all the people, or we can't really necessarily expect that. Mm-hmm. But that really opens up a lot of space for a lot of different types of integration folks to help, whether it's, depth psychology, whether mm-hmm. it's somatic experiencing, whether it's, movement work, whether it's art, whether it's, being out in whatever these different types of things are, there are different people that are sort of qualified and skilled in that area. So in a way, maybe we can turn this into something good, because now we can say, okay, now there's a lot of people out there that can sort of explore these realms through these different integration modalities. And then people will find kind of what is best for them in that process. But I definitely agree that there's this, and that's sort of, again, this psychologizing, the pharma/clinical model, like all these different approaches. When I was doing integration circles, when we started in 2011 with one of the other organizations I was doing, most of the people weren't coming there to talk about therapy, although there was some therapeutic things there. They were there because they're afraid to go to therapy, because they didn't want someone to diagnose them, right? And so what's the weirdness? What's the strange? What's the unusual? That's what the wonder and the awe. That's what people are really hungry to talk about. How can I access that? How can I remember something that's different? What types of symbols can I use? What types of ways, active imagination, other ways I can sort of tap into this that isn't going to be pathologizing, isn't going to be, stigmatizing, or, making it difficult for myself, my family, my job, or what have you, but just finding ways to sort of explore that on their own, exploring consciousness, which is something that we all should be doing. So I think that's, really big element in this integration process, is trying to figure out how we can all work together in this, realizing necessarily that those models aren't good, where the sort of one and done isn't good, but also that the psychologizing too much creates a box, which sometimes people, will spill over, and then feels like there's really some challenge there because they had an experience that was something and you could never have informed consent with some of these experiences, because you've never been there, then you don't even know how to inform somebody about the space beyond, if you will. Right. Which, speaking of that, I really want to kind of ask you about, we talk about this idea of collective unconscious. We talk about these spiritual realms. We talk about dream states. We talk about these spiritual sacred medicine places. How do you see this in terms of, this is kind of, again, one of those abstract, no correct answer type of questions, but how do you see the collective unconscious nesting with these different areas? Some people, can you access dreams through psychedelic spaces? Can you, can you find something? And, where do these all kind of fit together in your map of the psyche, if you will? In 2 seconds or less. No, just kidding.
Larry, this is why we just get off topic so easily. Let me really quickly touch on what the first thing that you said in the psychologizing. So that is why when I show up in these spaces, I'm not showing up as a therapist. I am showing up as a spiritual coach because I do think people are afraid of saying to someone who, has a therapist hat on, I saw this entity or this happened during this, what does it mean? And then a traditionally trained psychologist saying, oh, let's that might have to do with abuse from your, like just going down those paths that may not be appropriate for how the medicine was actually talking to them. So, as such, that's why I don't show up as a therapist in these spaces. Collective unconscious. So we, you and I have had these types of conversations, and it's, I would love to draw a map or something, and maybe I should someday. But in 2 seconds or less, okay. So
No,
I,
please take your time, take your time.
so the way that I look at my worldview is that there is Earth, which has its own consciousness, and that it is unto itself, as the whole universe is divine, as in it has purpose and consciousness and that meaning making woven into its very, on a very cellular level. So there, we'll stay on the earth though. So there's the earth, and then as a result of all of the both physical and spiritual evolution of everything that has happened on our planet, there is the collective unconscious, which kind of holds, let's look at it as all of the spiritual and psychic, as in from the psyche DNA of all of that which is from the planet. Did that make sense? Okay, so there is all of that. And as such, within the collective unconscious is all of the spirit that is embedded in all of these sacred medicines. So it is my belief that, like, the mushroom consciousness and the ayahuasca consciousness and the mescaline consciousness and the ergot consciousness are all very different. So they have their own spiritual DNA unto themselves, their own consciousness, their own purpose, which I don't believe necessarily has everything to do with how it changes the way we think, simply because we don't know how complex they're the reason why they exist is woven into everything else. But for us humans, beings that are walking around and can engage with these sacred substances through eating or smoking, that it then unlocks their messages within us. So if you look at it from that perspective, I think that we can tap back into, I don't think you could necessarily tap into it if you have never consumed it in some way, but it is, I strongly believe that once you have engaged with one of these plant beings in whatever way they have come to you, smoking, eating, that you then, some of their spiritual DNA is then linked into yours. And you can reaccess that at any time. And that does happen in dreams. Absolutely, it happens in dreams. I have had multiple dreams where I am literally being like pulled back into a trip that I've had, and maybe finishing it or maybe unlocking something that I didn't see when it was happening. But you can also do that through active imagination, through meditation, if you bring yourself back into that space. And I think that that's one of the ways in which Well, it's one of the ways that I work with integration is kind of going back in to being clicked into that spirit again. And therefore, you can speak with it again. You can unpack things that it showed you because it's always with you after you've had it.
Yeah, I think building, you know, we often hear that too with these different plants and mushrooms, that you're really building a relationship, and even your experiences then become different as you move forward, as you sort of get to know whatever this being is, or whatever this, I mean, this consciousness is. And I agree that there's different consciousness with the different plants. But yeah, once you sort of tap into it, it's all around. And, you know, you have an aha moment. There's this idea that I talked about in my dissertation about symbolic latency, where like sometimes you get these downloads, right? You hear this a lot. Oh, we got downloads. I get this download of information, right? And we don't know what it is. And I don't know. I don't even know what it was. I couldn't recognize it. It wasn't a real language that I could understand or whatever. It's just this download. And then down the road, something happens. You see something, you learn some things. You have a dream, you have a moment, you see a beautiful sunset, and all of a sudden, bam. All the symbol that was sort of like downloaded into you now comes forward in this huge, beautiful insight and this opportunity, this aha moment that you can now sort of reflect differently upon those experiences, you know? And so I think having and building those relationships is really such an important part of this, and really seeing them. I think my experiences personally have gone much better since I've sort of really seen them as another being that I'm relating to. And therefore, you know, we're both working together in this process. Now, I imagine for a lot of people out there, going back into these experiences in dream space or having these aha moments or whatever further down the line when they're not expecting it can be a little bit overwhelming. What sort of tips or tricks do you have for someone if they're like, hey, this is happening, and wow, all of a sudden I got, again, hit upside the head with this idea that I wasn't expecting, sort of calm themselves, to ground themselves, to be able to unpack the lesson? Because I think also, I always have this idea of homework assignments where we have to like sort of, you know, do the work to get the understanding. So how do we sort of ground ourselves in these new experiences and then also figure out how to move forward with this new insight so that we can develop a new access to growth?
Yeah. So that's that difficult piece of if you aren't working with somebody who has that directive in mind when you're first doing the medicine. But if, like you say, like something comes back in and it is overwhelming for them, taking deep breaths in through the nose and out through the mouth with a ha sound actually calms your nervous system. So that is something that I always do with my clients. I do at the beginning of every ritual, because I also am a priestess and I provide community rituals for all the equinoxes and solstices. So having everyone at the same time inhale and exhale with a ha several times brings you back into your body, helps calm your nervous system. So that's one of those things that people can do at any point. I mean, even during a journey or a trip that is going sideways and is overwhelming, just that simple act of inhaling and exhaling with a ha can reconnect you to your body. So that's one thing. I am a huge fan of homework for any reason, but journaling and art, even if you don't think you're an artist, because that I don't believe in that, actually. I think that anyone can make art, so much so that, you know, if you don't feel like you can draw or something, you know, grab a stack of magazines and start collaging, bringing whatever it is, either through art or writing, bringing whatever it is into the concrete realm. I mean, even getting some clay and like making a blob, like bringing it from just being in your head where it's like, to a physical space helps transmute that energy, helps ground you, because it is no longer just something that's flying around inside your mind. Right. And I think you can do that with any type of experience like this, having had it or something popping up, like you're saying, it's like guts unlocked by a sunset and you're like, whew, that was a lot. What do I do? And one of the big problems is that, you know, then your brain is like spinning with that and literally pulling it out and putting it on paper in some way, I think is a really key way to do that. I have done work with people with very small doses of LSD and working with archetypes and Symbols are also great with that. So in that process that I do with people, we walk a labyrinth, but then in their integration homework, they draw a labyrinth and they're able to go back into that symbol again. So ways that people can work with it is creating their own symbol or sigil of whatever it is that they can't quite understand so that they can look at it and continue to process it. So yeah, really, it's really important to just get it out onto something.
I agree that the externalization is such, you know, like you're saying, is such an important part, because now we can sort of look at it, pick it up, especially, you know, I don't, because I think it's just a lot, but like the idea of like working with clay, or, you know, this type of thing, just getting your hands in there and just making some weird shape, doesn't even have to be anything special. You know, I'm same way with the art that I do. You know, it's like, you know, I don't paint what I sometimes I do paint what I'm thinking about, but it's oftentimes I paint to see what's in the piece. Oh, there's a little face here, like kind of like pareidolia, I believe it's called, right? Where you're kind of looking, you're seeing faces and shapes and symbols and all that kind of thing, and how important that is for, you know, A, just being able to get it out there, and B, then later you come back, and I have journeys from, you know, 2000 ayahuasca journeys, you know, or from 2000 year 2000, right? That I go back to now, and or paintings that I've done, and as soon as I see it, it's like I'm right back in that experience. I don't know, words, no extra stuff, you know, that symbol, even if it's super weird and abstract, it's like I'm there, right? Same thing, I think, with like listening to certain music that you were listening to at the time can help bring memories forward. And I agree, like drawing your own symbol, like this labyrinth, you know, practice you're talking about, how important that is to like, oh yeah, okay, you just kind of get in that flow. You kind of remove the verbal, remove the left brain and allow the right brain to really kind of come in there and really sort of, you know, dance with you, if you will, you know, in terms of that experience. And then that's so important. And when you work with people, are you finding that a lot of folks are, you know, what's kind of the range for some of these experiences that people are coming to you and like, oh, I really need integration? Is there, you find like there's a theme, or the people that are really like seeking integration, or is it kind of all over the place for you?
There have been people who have had ayahuasca journeys, where even if they've worked with, we'll say, an indigenous elder, that there are things that came up for them that they were not able to understand at the point of the journey. And, you know, years later or months later, they're like, oh my gosh, what was that? And I wasn't given any tools and there wasn't any homework. And what do I do with this? So people who are kind of overwhelmed with information that they were unable to process at the time. So there's that. There are people who have had, a friend handed them an eighth of mushrooms and they ate the whole bag and then they had a really great time, or they had a really great time and then a really horrible time. And they're like, I hear a lot of times, I felt like there was something I was supposed to understand. I hear that a lot. Like, can you help me understand that thing I don't understand? And I don't help anybody. Like, I never tell somebody, this is what it meant. I never do that. Let's just make that clear. And much like in chaplaincy, you help the person get to the information on their own. So there never should be. So, I mean, this is my own point of view, of course, but I don't think that there should be any integration work where you tell somebody something and then they go, oh, this is what that meant. Because they don't have your psyche. They don't have your unconscious. There is no way that somebody else can interpret. It's like dream interpretation. Jung was a proponent of the person understanding what is their dream, not somebody telling you what it was. So people who are coming from that perspective of like, I felt like there was something I was being told, that happens a lot. And then those two types are more often than the people who are like, oh my God, I had a really, really bad trip and it's still haunting me. That actually happens less often than I expected. But that as well. At which point it's like, okay, well, you have to realize that we're going to kind of dive back into that and it might be a little scary again, but the only way we're going to get to the core of it is if we revisit it. So, and I'm not trying to re-traumatize people. I simply am going, okay, well, if there was something that scared you, we might have to look at it very closely in order for you to understand why it scared you. Right.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you're so right about the idea of the directive integration. And you see that so many people that are going in that route, and, you know, it's a hyper-suggestible experience. You're so looking for meaning that you're willing to have somebody else supplant the meaning for you. Like, there's a lot of different sort of reasons why that directive approach, you know, doesn't work so well. And I've seen some folks that are pretty well respected in the world, and that's their style. It's very directive, you know, and you're like, man, you know, and you see the people are like, they're like, some people are almost a little resistant to it because they're just like, this doesn't feel right, you know, but, you know, taking the time. And that's, I think that's, again, maybe a byproduct of the culture we're in, where we got to like, get it fast, you can do it. Okay, I want to integrate today, right now, boom, 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 you know, instead of being like, this is going to take some time. This might take some subtle nuances that you got to explore. That's, you know, woven into this crack over here. And you think you're looking over here and maybe the answer is, you know, somewhere else. So really like taking that time to do it. And you were saying earlier about this meaning making, you know, it really is, it's about that person making their own meaning, you know, figuring it out. And yes, of course we're there for discernment. We're there for, you know, feedback, you know, and these different types of things. But at the end of the day, that individual is really going to be the one that's going to find out and understand those symbols, because they're the only one that knows, you know, it's only them and their experience. Right. And we're just there to kind of, you know, bounce the ideas back to them so that they can kind of see what's going on there. So I think that's really, really, really critical part of doing the integration work as well. Yeah. And then now when you kind of then now take this into sort of the chaplaincy world, it sounds like you said you have a lot of the people that you speak to, you know, at school and things like that are kind of coming from a pagan approach, but there's a lot of different sort of religious ideals out there and ideologies. Do you find that, like, you know, each way do you have to work with people a little differently according to their ideology? How do you sort of fit things in certain frameworks, or, you know, have them fit it into that framework? What's sort of the approach if, like, somebody has, like, for example, there are people that I know in the Christian framework who are like, well, you know, these plants came from God, so therefore they're fantastic. And other people's like, oh, these are, you know, the devil's weed or whatever else. So, you know, obviously, even in some of these certain ideologies, there might be differences with how people interpret these experiences. How do you work with these different ideologies as people come to you? Again, I know you're trying to help them have the experience or the meaning emerge from them, mm-hmm. but is there any kind of techniques that you would suggest for people to have a variety of different approaches?
Mm-hmm. So I have not had the privilege yet of meeting any of the Christian folks who are using these because they come from God, which I also kind of agree with. I mean, my God is different, but I would love to work with somebody who, and I know that those groups exist, but the way that I always set up the work that I do with people from a psychedelic perspective is I am just straight up. I say, I am coming at this through an archetypal lens, and using archetypes kind of distills everything down to its base material. Because then it's not, you know, Zeus came to you, it's a father figure, right? So kind of being able to peel back the dogma for anyone, pagan or otherwise. I mean, I call myself pagan just because it's easier, but I don't know if I even still, because I definitely did in college, but I don't even know if I still like really hold on to the concepts of gods and goddesses, because I've peeled back all of that to the archetypal realm. So I will say, this is how I am showing up. When you tell me something, if you are interested in what that might be archetypally, let me know and I'll share it with you. So I never say, oh, that's the mother archetype. You know, when they're like talking about someone who came to them in their journey work, yet again, not telling them but saying, oh, could you tell me more? Or that, then, you know, do you want me to tell you what that sounds like to me? That sound like it might have been the mother archetype. That sounds like it might have been the healer archetype. That might have been the artist archetype. You know, does that resonate for you? So always asking more questions. So that's a huge piece about chaplaincy in general, is that chaplains show up in a space asking questions and asking questions and asking questions so that they can continue to hold up that mirror to the person. There's a lot in, you know, I heard you say, which I also use in my integration work, I heard you say this. Does that resonate with you? And those types of pulling out the material, holding up the mirror, pulling out the material, holding up the mirror, which is the same in integration work as it is to chaplaincy. I think that answered your question.
Yeah. And then you were just speaking a little bit earlier, and maybe this kind of can tie in as well, as you did a recent research looking at microdosing and these labyrinths and sort of these. So any interesting results you want to share, or any thoughts around that project that you want to sort of share, or where can people find out if they want to learn more?
I did two rounds of trials. Well, first of all, I did a couple of rounds of trials on my own, trying to click into which medicine would create the doorway to specifically help people meet the archetype at the center of their purpose. Because one of the people who followed in Jung's footsteps was a man named James Hillman, and he had this concept of the acorn, which is that everyone has come into this life with a blueprint of what they're supposed to do in their life. And very much wanting to be able to like have a direct line into what that is, I went, what medicine would work for this? So mushrooms didn't work for that, but that's a story for another time. I think because they very much have their own intent. And so clicking into this other intent didn't really work with them, but LSD did work with that. And so I did two rounds of trials, small dose of LSD, sent people into a labyrinth. When they got to the center of the labyrinth, they met that entity, came back out, and then we did some integration work to talk to that entity. And then there was homework and then group work with other people who had also gone through the process. I'm still crunching all of that data, but I would say that there was about an 80% success rate in that they had a encounter with this guiding archetype that they were then able to take back into their life, that information, and utilize that information to make big changes in their life. So 80%, pretty big number. Unfortunately, there have been a couple of people who like looked that information dead in the face and then decided to kind of continue on in bad behaviors and bad habits. But I think that's going to be true of really anything. I mean, any form of therapy, there's going to be people who are like, oh yeah, that's really great, and then just kind of continue on doing what they were doing in the first place. So all of this information you can find at revpamelaDawn.com. So revpamelaDawn.com. I am providing that as a service now. And there's the integration and coaching on there as well.
And maybe share a little bit more about the Star King certificate program as well. What's happening outside of the awesome teacher you have for the advocacy class? but that sounds really interesting, and I'm sure it sounds like it's going really well and people are really enjoying it. And maybe just share a little bit about folks, how they can contact that, or you know, get involved as well.
So starking.edu, starrking.edu, is our website. And or no, I'm wrong. SKSM, Star King School for the Ministry.edu. SKSM.edu, not starking.edu. I think that might take you to the elementary school. SKSM.edu drop down menu, there's certificate. It shows certificate in psychedelic justice and companioning. You do not need to apply to any of our master's degree programs to do the certificate work. And right now I'm teaching psychedelic ministry methods, which has been absolutely phenomenal. We are looking at above board folks who are using this in more psychotherapy realms as a template, but this is helping people kind of tap into what medicine they are going to be the ally for, and then how they can then perhaps craft a program or decide on if they want to do, guide work or integration work. And then how they can take that out into the world, like really working with integrity, and also a huge focus on countering oppression, all woven into that.
Great. Yeah, I've met a few folks already from your program, and they've all been, this is, the wisdom is there. You can see that, they're bringing in interesting information also from the outside world into the program. So it's I'm excited to see how that continues on, and thank you for doing that. And I know that Rachel has one question, and then maybe we can have a couple more thoughts, and then we can wrap up after that. But it's been what a incredible fun dive into consciousness here. So thank you, Pamela, for this, and
Oh
Rachel.
yeah. Oh my gosh, what a great conversation. I was like, so I have so many questions, but I'm going to synthesize it to one that I thought that was most pertinent. So I love what you said about meaning making, as well as like working in dreams and like people having their own like glossary of how they're like interpreting these messages or these energies. So I always have a saying to my friends, I'm like, well, what's the difference between a dream and a memory? After all, right? And if you're remembering a dream you forgot you had. So I just wanted to get your sense, just this question about what are your thoughts about the more magical aspects of dreams, such as like people appearing in your dreams, or shared dreaming, or prophetic dreams, or astral travel? What are your personal opinions on that kind of stuff?
Oh my goodness, Rachel, like literally 5 hours on this. Like,
Oh my
you
gosh, I know we could have a whole show about dreams and stuff. So, yeah, like just what are your thoughts about like dreaming or dream
Yeah.
time in general?
Right. Yeah. Funny that you said dream time because I did a whole research project on the dream time
Love it.
during college, because I actually had a class on body modification in college, which was freaking rad. And so we like looked at the history of tattoos and body mod, and the fact that I was so awestruck by the Aboriginal use of like painting the body as a way to get directly into the dream time, which is less about dreams and more about this other reality that's kind of laying on top of our reality. So I think the dreams are pretty much like that. It's this other reality that is laying atop of our reality, and thus ancestors, the departed, can kind of drop into that, probably because it's all, sinewy and connected to underworld, overworld, all of that. Much like why people can have a dream where their friend pops up and that friend is actually having that dream as well, because it's probably connected to the collective unconscious and it's probably all at the same time. And it is a sacred space because of that fact, because of the, it's like, a layer that probably is interwoven into the other spiritual layers that are always there that we go into when we use these sacred medicines. And from that perspective, spiritual things can happen. I mean, I've had direct contact with ancient Celtic gods in dream time, because I think that they're like, oh, look, there's one of the ones that believe in us still. Let's
No, it's
go
so.
in.
Oh my gosh, I just got full body tingles when you said that. That's so, yeah. No, like, have you ever seen the show American Gods? So like that, right? Like Odin, like they're like, we're you see us because you believe in us, right? And it's so tied to that. And children are so, like, I love talking to kids about this stuff because they so get it. And we grow up and we like forget how to like interpret the dream messages. So
Right.
yeah.
And they see the things that we have forgot to see. I have a 7-year-old, and still to this day, we have an ancestor altar. And when one of those ancestors is coming around, he'll be like, "Oh, so and so is here." And I'll feel it. Like, I don't see them anymore like I used to when I was a kid, but he can see them. And I'm like,
Yeah.
"Yes."
I love that. Oh, thank you for sharing that. Love that.
And we'll have to sit over some
Oh, we
tea.
have. Oh, we've got like follow-up conversations that need to happen
Absolutely.
after this.
Yes.
Back to you, Larry.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you both. Thank you, Rachel, for the questions. And thank you, Pamela, for an incredible talk. I guess any last things you want to talk about or anything that we didn't touch on at all or any other plugs you'd like to make before we head out?
That just if you're interested in really doing this work with people and perhaps not having to like click into some sort of like legal framework like in Oregon, and you care about the medicine and you care about other humans, that the certificate program, it's just unlike anything else that's out there right now. And so I highly recommend, just there's a way to set up a talk with our admissions person, and that person can get you in contact with me. Just if you're passionate about this, it's a really great place to start, especially because Larry's going to be talking about policy.
Right, exactly. And is there a way for them to, or we can put that into a little blurb, I guess, at the bottom. Is there a good way to contact you, or just contact them and they'll get a hold of you?
So they can contact me through it on the SKSM.edu. There is a link with my email address. If they're just interested in working with me one-on-one, revpamela.com, there's a at the bottom of the coaching page, there's like a contact me about blah blah blah. You can just plop it in.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure I'm sure there's going to be a lot of amazing things happening in the near future. And again, I just really want to thank you for being here and I look forward to another conversation where we can dive a little deeper. Thank you for all the work you're doing out there and for continuing to
Thank you.
bring the good work to the people. I think that's really important. And thank you everyone else for being here. Thank you, Rachel, as well. It's been really a great pleasure to have this conversation. Every other Sunday, we're doing this live. So keep on our podcast thing to make sure that it's there. And then next week, we'll be posting this on Spotify, this actual conversation, and other platforms as well. The next podcast we're going to be having is on Sunday, March 30th. And that will be with special guest Daniel Kruger, who is doing some amazing survey-based research looking at decriminalized cities and seeing what types of things people are sort of experiencing, how it's benefiting them or what have you. So I want to check that out. He also knows a lot about the different work that's going on out there and kind of a little bit more of an academic voice, in terms of the survey stuff, but really interesting in terms of some of the questions he's asking and the ways that he's come about thinking about this. And I've really enjoyed this amazing mystical academic conversation we've been having. So thank you again. Thank you for being out there.
Thank you, Rachel.
Oh,
my
yeah, definitely. And
goodness.
thank you everyone for listening in. Until next time, tune in, stay rooted, and let's grow together. Have a great day. Happy Sunday.
Bye, everybody.
Plant power to the people. Plant power to the people. Where you dream.